The following is a 1250 WTMA special presentation.
This is John Quincy with another hour of the History of TMA, our ongoing look back at the legacy of the station that's been serving Charleston and the Lowcountry of South Carolina since 1939.
Now hear this, we're the Tiger of Radio, WTMA Radio Charleston.
In previous hours of the history of TMA, we've interviewed many of the people that have made 1250 WTMA their on-air home. Most have been disc jockeys from WTMA's days as a music-formatted station. But this hour, we're going to hear from some of the folks who, when the mighty TMA DJs took a break from keeping the station's listeners entertained, kept them informed by doing the news.
From Communications Exchange, WTMA. Comax News!
First up is Tom Berry.
I came to WTMA in August of 1970. I had been working at WYCL Radio, which is in York and Rock Hill area, as news director, and of course a small market radio station. I was a one-man gang, and I was also doing an on-air stint as well as doing news for the station at the time. And so vacancy came up, and I applied with Franco Hunt, who was the news director at the time, and that's how I ended up coming to WTMA.
Were you excited about it?
I was very excited about it. I knew about the station before, because at the time, there were several of us radio news guys that had a somewhat informal radio news regional network. Basically, what we were doing would be calling each other in the early morning hours to check and see if there were any interesting stories out of their area. We had Tom Martin, who was the news director at WORD in Spartanburg, which is where I got my start in my hometown. And Frank O'Hunt was in Charleston at WTMA. Jerry Pate and Jay Latham were at WIS Radio in Columbia. And I was at WYCL in York, handling York, Rock Hill, and doing some stuff out of Charlotte at the time as well. And so we would talk with each other every morning just to swap stories so that we could have some more regional flavor and to get additional voices on the air. And so that's how I found out that Frank was going to have a vacancy, because his afternoon guy was leaving, and if my memory serves me correctly, that was Bill Sharp, who was going back to school at the University of Georgia after having worked there for the summer. And so I had the opportunity to go down and visit the station, and all I had to do was to walk in and meet Frank and look at the newsroom and talk with him for a few minutes, and that's all it took.
You think WTMA had a pretty good reputation, their news department anyway, before you came down?
I think it had a very good reputation. Frank O'Hunt was very well connected within the community. The station was very well respected, very connected in the greater Charleston community. It was where the local folks went for local news and information as to what was happening at the time. And it gave me a wonderful opportunity to learn a lot about the business, because I was still very young at the time, very green, and I was able to come in. Frank was able to teach me an awful lot, and I was able to develop my skills there working with not only Frank, but everyone else at the station there, and then was able to go on from there. It was a wonderful, wonderful time.
So you and Frank got along okay, huh?
Yes, we only had about three or four downright fights, but once Charleston PD came and got everybody separated, it was fine. No, we worked very well together. Anybody who knows Frank knows what a consummate professional he is and how easily he is to work with. And so that was one of the things that attracted me to the job itself, because I knew Frank from his reputation. I knew about the stories that he generated in the Charleston area, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. And plus, when I got down there, I was able to meet the other people on the staff, John Trenton, who was the program director at the time, and the other members of the staff who were just fabulous to work with. And of course, it was an absolute hoot working with Boob, because I did afternoons. Working with Booby and everybody else was just a treat.
Do you remember your impression of WTMA the first time you heard it on the air, not only as a news operation, but as a top 40 radio station coming from York and some of the other markets you'd worked at?
I was just absolutely amazed that the station had a very crisp, clean sound. You know, when you're into business, you listen for little nuances. You listen for little things like compression and other things that may be going on so that you get a better feel for what it actually sounds like from the technical side of things. But yet at the same time I was listening, it was a very tightly run station. You could tell these were professionals. These were people who knew exactly what they were doing, and I wanted to be a part of it because I had listened to WTMA whenever I had been in Charleston before, and when I would come there, I would always listen to the mighty TMA. And so it was just an absolute delight to be able to get the opportunity to actually walk in the door and get a paycheck from them. At the time, we were owned by Ted Turner because all of the paychecks were Turner Communications.
The news operation there was just you and Franco Hunt, right? Was there anybody else involved?
It was the two of us for the time that I was there. Frank would do mornings. I would come in about 10 o'clock in the morning, and if there was any street work that needed to be done, I would go out and do the street work and then come back and anchor the afternoon newscast. The newsroom itself was right at the end of the hallway as you come in from the front offices. We were right next to all of the production rooms and the large anteroom area outside of John Trenton's office where the jocks had their desks. And we had the old style teletype machine, which was in the newsroom with us. So anytime that mic would go on, you would always hear the teletype in the background clattering away. You'd hear the bells go off as part of the newscast itself.
What about John Trenton? What were your reactions working with the guy?
John was very much the professional. He ran a very strong operation. I thoroughly enjoyed my time working with John, although I didn't have that much in the way of interaction with him because Frank was primarily the go-between. But one story I remember about John, he was always so good and so on whenever he was on the air. I remember one morning, Frank was on vacation and I was pulling the morning shift. And I'm not sure what was going on with John, whether he had enjoyed himself a little too much the night before or whether he was actually physically ill. But it was one of those mornings where when there was something going on, whether there was some function, whether it was a record or it was a spot set or whatever it was, John's head was literally on the counter. The boy just could not move. Then whenever the mic would get turned on, I mean, it was like a different person. He was just there and just 110% full bore. And as soon as the mic pot would go off, you'd hear the head hit the counter again. But that was the kind of person John Trenton was. And everybody was very loyal to John. He ran a very good operation. I never heard of any dissension within the ranks, no back talking or anything like that. It was a very, very homogeneous group of us that worked together. John was doing the mornings. Bob Riley was coming in doing 9 to noon. Ted Bell was then doing, I believe, noon to 3, and then Booby would come in and do 3 to 7. And it was a very, very close-knit group. And it was just an absolute delight to work with them. It's one of those situations you always look for the kind of job where you can go in and you can do a good job, but at the same time, you're having fun with it. It's like the old cliche, geez, all this fun and a paycheck too? Wow.
Now, I understand that the news people weren't the best paid people on the WTMA staff.
I don't know if anybody was the best paid person on the staff. I'm sure you could probably get that from anyone. I was trying to remember, I was racking my brain to how much I was making at the time. I know that when I was at WYCL in York, I think I was making all of about $125 to $140 a week. And I know I came to TMA and I was thinking that I came for either $150, $155 a week. But to me, it was just absolutely fabulous because not only was I getting to go to a bigger market, I was getting to pursue my news career, which I dearly loved, and I was able to work with people that I enjoyed, that I respected. And all of that, you know, plus a paycheck increase too. I mean, geez, what's not to like?
What about some of the other folks that worked at WTMA? Do you remember any of the night people you worked with?
I remember some of the night people we had. One in particular that I helped to get to Charleston was a friend of mine that I worked with in York at WYCL. The gentleman's name was Bill Towery, who used the name John Scott or J.J. Scott. The night guy left. And Jack Daniels, and I cannot remember his name, but he was working the overnights. Jack moved into the night slot, and so that left the overnight slot vacant. And so I saw John Trenton, and I said, John, I've got a friend of mine up in York who's very good at production, bright guy, really good, got a fairly good set of pipes. and would probably jump at the chance to come down here. And so Bill came down to Charleston, met with John, and then came to work at TMA, initially doing overnights, then he moved to nights, and then he moved into day slots and was doing production. JJ moved into that slot very quickly. It was a situation where he came on board and was there for quite some time in the early to mid-1970s. In fact, after I came to Columbia, when I got married, I asked him if he would be one of my groomsmen, and he came up here. One of the funniest things that I ever saw in my life was JJ had a Harley, and he drove to Columbia with our wedding present on the back of his Harley. He had gotten us an oversized Pawleys Island rope hammock that he had strapped crosswise across the back wheel of the Harley. So he looked, coming up the Interstate 26 to Columbia on his Harley, looking like he has this tail wing on the back of his Harley. It's the funniest thing I'd ever seen in my life, because he was driving up the interstate, long hair blowing in the breeze, and then got this huge hammock hanging on the back of this Harley.
You know, J.J. Scott eventually became program director when John Trenton decided that he couldn't do it anymore when he got the promotion to general manager. I believe that J.J. was the PD.
I believe he was, and was there for some time before moving on to Chicago at WFYR, is where he went when he left Charleston. He was there for a good while, and I would like to think, at least from the interaction I had with him and hearing from some of the other folks, did a pretty good job while he was there. As I mentioned before in the conversation, working with Boobie Nash was just an absolute hoot, because Boob was always the practical joker. He was always doing things, but he was always terribly, terribly supportive. And if I would blow a newscast or make some mistake or something would happen, Boob was always there saying, well, don't worry about it, we'll get it squared away the next time. Or if he was late getting into a newscast, which of course never happened, and so he'd always come down the hall, don't worry, we'll take care of it next time, I'll get it to you on time, don't worry, I'm not going to make you wait, don't worry about it. And then light up another cigarette and go back to the control room and everything would be fine. But, oh gosh, it was just such fun.
How about Bob Riley?
Bob, I generally didn't have a whole lot of interaction with, because Bob was working the morning side of the time, working, I believe it was 9 to noon at the time. And generally, when I would come in the mornings, I'd come in, check with Frank, see if there was anything going on, and then I'd generally head out to go cover whatever assignments needed to be covered to get some tape that we could come back and then use for the newscasts later on in the day. And then Frank would go out at middays, a lot of times after wrapping up the newscast, so that he could put together the public affairs show that we had every Sunday morning called Charleston Speaks. And if anybody knew what Frank was doing, he was going to the civic club circuits, and he was taping the speeches, and then he would come back, and he would say, well, okay, well, this was a pretty good speech, and he'd just run the speech. And that was Charleston Speaks. So a lot of times I would come in the morning and then would immediately head out again. So I didn't have a lot of interaction with Bob. Ted, on the other hand, of course, Ted was working early afternoons at the time. Very professional, very smooth, just straightforward. You knew exactly what was going to be happening with Ted. Everything seemed to be right in order.
What do you think WTMA meant to Charleston during the early 70s? How important was the radio station to this area?
I think it was synonymous. I think it was just literally Charleston was WTMA and WTMA was Charleston. Everything that we did was just geared toward what is it that we can do for Charleston. At the time and in those years, it was WTMA and, oh yeah, there were a bunch of other radio stations that were around there, but geez, they had about as many listeners as the police calls did. And so it was one of those magical times that you always wanted to be part of, because you knew that there was something magic about what was happening here. This was a station that was very much a part of the community. I would go into businesses, and being in radio, you have that wonderful anonymity of not having your face immediately recognized, but you would speak up and you would just start talking, and people would look up, oh, I know you. You work at TMA. And it was never WTMA, but it was TMA. Or, oh, you work at the mighty TMA. We used to think to ourselves, and there probably was a little bit of truth to it somewhere, that, geez, you know, the station could be blown off the air, and then 3 years later would still be number one in the books. Because it was one of those situations where the station was just so dominant. It was so good from all aspects, from the engineering side, the crispness of the sound of the station itself, to the people who were on the air, to the people that were out selling the station, representing the station. We did a lot of remotes. We did a lot of things out in the community, and it showed because there was always a very, very close bond between the station and the community it served.
Coming up, another newsman who was here in the 70s, Steve Bell.
You're listening to the History of TMA with John Quincy on 1250 WTMA. Listening to the History of TMA.
This hour on the History of TMA, we're talking to some of the station's newsmen from the past, like Steve Bell.
SLED may be the subject of a federal investigation. This is Steve Bell, WTMA News.
I went to WTMA in the spring of 1975, and I left in the, I think it was May of 1978.
And where were you before you came to WTMA?
I was with WGOW in Chattanooga, Tennessee, which coincidentally, both WGOW and WTMA were once Turner stations. WGOW was still a Turner station when I was there. I was news director there and was laid off, as I suspect it was had something to do with the fact that I was sending some resumes and tapes out, you know, always trying to move up in the world, as we seem to always do in the radio business. And someone in management found out about it, apparently, and decided they would cool my heels for me. And I understood, I had heard through the grapevine that the plan was lay him off for a little while and then bring him back and he'll behave himself. The day after I was laid off, one of my resumes and tape mailings came through, and the following Monday I was on the air at WTMA and WPXI.
Did you come aboard as news director at WTMA?
No, I was just a news reporter. Al Cammie was the news director, someone I have great respect for. He was an excellent investigative journalist, and we worked together for a couple of years, and the last few months I was there, Al Cammie left, and they brought in John Dozier as the news director.
WTMA was a fairly music-intensive radio station, but it seems like the station in the 70s placed a lot of emphasis on news.
I think that's very accurate. Again, at a top 40 station, the music is the thing, and the amount of time devoted to news was not that great. I think there were seven live newscasts a day, and they were relatively short. But there was a focus on quality, and I'm not sure if that came so much from management as it did from the news director, Al Cammie. We never or hardly ever read wire copy. Even when we reported a wire story, we rewrote it. We had a pattern, a practice of using a lot of little sound bites, either live, it was a news conference or something, or by phone. We did a lot of telephone interviews and cut those up. And I think that probably in every newscast, we would have maybe six or more actualities, which for a 5 to 10 minute newscast is quite a few.
Now, WTMA in the mid-70s was still carrying the Mutual Network newscast, weren't they?
We did not carry the Mutual newscast. We would tape them and take bits and pieces from them to plug into our local newscast. I don't recall ever running Mutual newscasts per se. Maybe that was done in the middle of the night or something.
Now, was it just you and Al taking care of the whole news department there?
It was. And then later, John and I.
A typical day for you, what would that be like?
Initially, my working hours were from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. I would come in and help Al prepare for the midday news, which I guess was 12:25, and we would co-anchor that particular session of the news. Then in the afternoon, I believe that we had news at 4:25, 5:25, and 6:25. I may be off an hour one way or the other. And also, we did the news for the FM station, which was essentially the same newscast, but we redid it using their intros and references to the FM station and recorded those on an NAB cartridge, which was then played back the machine was in the newsroom. It was played back by the automation equipment in the FM at the appropriate times. Of course, when I first arrived, WPXI was a beautiful music station, but later on it was changed into the soul station, as we called it in those days. And I have never heard, even with today's computerized operations, you know, it was an amazingly tight automation setup for the soul station. In those days, you would think of automation as being the beautiful music kind of thing, where you'd have a lot of pauses between songs and between spots, and that was not the case with the soul station. The engineer, Charlie McCann, was one of the geniuses who was at WTMA, and he managed to set it up so that it sounded almost live. Very tight. They had the time announcements, two carts that one had the even times and the other had the odd times, and they cycled through every minute so that they, always the correct time was there, an announcement by a local announcer, and it was run in so close, so tight with everything else that it sounded live. So during the afternoon, of course, the first part of the afternoon would be spent preparing for the afternoon news, getting the wire copy, rewriting it, doing interviews, sometimes attending news conferences. Charleston seemed to have quite a few newsmakers in town. General Westmoreland was there, and there were some what they called saber rattling in Korea in those days. And, of course, he had been in Korea, so he knew a lot about that. Dr. Albert Sabin was there and was active in connection with the swine flu vaccine. With the Citadel there also, there were a lot of politicians and military people. And so there were fairly frequent news conferences. So we had to work those in as well. And a lot of times that meant working on during time frames that you were not actually on duty. Now, if there was a news conference at, say, 9 o'clock in the morning and Al Cammy was on the air doing the news, then I needed to be there to cover it. Or I would do the news and he would cover it. We just played that by ear. And then, of course, during the actual air times, it was really touch and go. You had to work very quickly to get the next newscast ready after taping the FM newscast. So, you know, what's maybe 15 minutes out of every hour was spent actually reporting the news. So that only left 45 minutes for preparation. So you tried to get as much of that done earlier in the afternoon as possible. After the last newscast in the evening, I would tape, as I recall, three newscasts to run overnight.
Who was the program director there when you were there, or did you have several?
I'm trying to think. Lee Richards was there for a while, and Bob McLean. We didn't really deal that closely with the programming end, and maybe that's what made the news, you know, a higher priority than most top 40 stations, is that we were left alone to do our thing, pretty much. I know that at one time, one of the program directors, and it's probably fortunate that I can't remember which one, made the announcement, and this was, we felt, sort of the first time that our independence had been infringed upon a little bit, but the decision was made by programming that every newscast would start with a local story, never start with a national story. And I remember that I followed that rule to the letter, which got me in trouble at one time because Elvis Presley died during my days there. I started the newscast with a local story, as instructed. And, of course, you know, on a top 40 radio station, Elvis Presley's death was the story of the year. And I got to it eventually, but it was not the first story. But generally speaking, programming left the news department alone. I think that's what made it possible for us to do the job that we did.
We'll hear more from Steve Bell coming up next on the History of TMA.
Here's more radio memories from John Quincy's vault.
You're listening to the History of TMA.
WTMA.
Now, here's more from our conversation with mid-70s WTMA newsman Steve Bell.
I liked most all the people that I worked with. Bob James was the graveyard shift DJ, and he and I became very close friends. Turns out we were born 2 days apart, and we were a fairly close group, I would say. John Burwell was another of the geniuses. I would say that he and Charlie McCann were the geniuses while I was there. And, of course, in totally different areas. Charlie was the engineer, and he had interesting systems set up. I think they had two three-decks of cart machines in the control room and two turntables. And Charlie had it set up so that you could flip a switch, and not only would one cart trigger the other, but when the last cart played, it would start the turntable. So if you needed a bathroom break, you know, you had quite a few minutes, the station would more or less operate itself. Charlie also was a big classic movie fan. He would travel around the Southeast. When he would see a movie that he didn't have playing in Jacksonville or Columbia or Atlanta, he would go there that weekend, rent a motel room, and tape that movie. So he had an amazing collection of classic movies and would occasionally invite some of us over to watch movies. And he had created this device, which he called the McMute. His name was McCann, so everything was McSomething. And when we would be watching TV at his house, say watching a movie on TV, a commercial came on. He seemed to know the length of the spots that were coming on TV, and he had three buttons on a box beside his chair. One was 30 seconds, one was 1 minute, and one was 2 minutes. And if it was a two-minute commercial break, commercial started, he punched the two-minute button, and the TV would go off for 2 minutes.
Wow.
And come back on. If it was 2.5 minutes, he could push the 2 minute and the 30 second. He had the station sounding great. He had it as convenient as possible for the people who worked there. You know, considering the technology of the day, it's nothing like the digital operations of today. But and then John Burwell, to me, his genius was in the production area. He worked many, many hours beyond the call of duty to get it right. The Pussycat Hose spot, John took the background music of What's New Pussycat by Tom Jones, and at the very end of that song, it ends with something about Pussycat nose, and John wanted it to say hose instead of nose. So he pulled out a copy of the same singer's version of Green Green Grass of Home, and he took the off of home and spliced it into Pussycat nose, and it said Pussycat hose. And I swear you could not tell the difference.
Wow, that's pretty creative.
It sounded like it was recorded that way. And of course, you know, we're talking about the technology of splicing tape. This is not digital stuff. Rudy Gresham, that John Burwell mentioned on his remembrance, of course, was quite a character. I think he had been in the Marines, if I'm not mistaken, maybe a Green Beret or something, Special Forces, or he had been a top-notch military person, and he was always jokingly, you know, threatening you or pulling you down, grabbing you or something. And I remember one time that, and maybe this was my intro to the law business, but at one time he grabbed a hold of me and did something, and I went to the courthouse and got a hold of a copy of a complaint or a warrant or some sort of legal paper and wrote up one hailing him before the court for the injury that he caused to me, and we all got a laugh out of that.
What do you think WTMA meant to Charleston during the time that you were at the radio station?
At the time I was there, and I think Burwell said it well, that it was a flip-flop. Once the Soul Station started, every book that came out, it was either WTMA or WPXI was number one, and the other one was number two. They totally dominated. It was the radio station. And maybe that's one reason that the station allowed the news department the time and the facilities to do what it needed to do, because there was something of a responsibility to the people to not only provide the music that they liked, but also to keep them informed. We tried to concentrate the news area on what was important to our listeners.
Did you see any other radio stations in town as your competition?
Oh, yeah. WKTM was one. At least in my view, that was the biggest competitor for our format. And it was interesting that Booby Nash, who I think was at WTMA and then went to WKTM and then came back to WTMA, as I recall. A friend of mine, Bob James, I've mentioned him before, had started to make a move to go. I mean, when you're on the graveyard shift, obviously you want to move up. And he tried to go to WKTM, and WTMA brought legal action against him. I think they did not get their temporary restraining order, and he did, as I recall, go to work there. WTMA was vigorous in trying to protect their station from the staff leaving, going across the street, as we used to say. They didn't mind if you went far away, but they didn't want you to go to the direct competition, and I certainly understand that. I had some thoughts at one time of going to WKTM myself, but when Bob James's experience, based on his experience, I decided not to try it.
Did he sign a contract saying that he would not work for anybody else?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Well. We were all required to sign, and not when I initially went there. It was some time after that, which we thought wasn't really fair as far as sign this contract or lose your job. It would make more sense if the contracts were signed at the beginning of the employment. And they probably did that once they started using the contracts. But yes, we were required to sign contracts with non-competition language. And I think that the court in Bob James's case ultimately ruled that the language was too vague. The courts are reluctant to enforce those things. And if they can find some grounds for not enforcing them, then they usually do. I mentioned Booby Nash. I worked with him for a short time, I think in 78, before I left. He was a lot of fun. We would have a few friendly poker games, even with some WKTM people. And as far as I know, that was not discouraged. In fact, I was a roommate with one of the KTM people for a few months. His name was John Patterson.
What about news competition? When you guys went out and covered stories, I guess you encountered the newspaper and the TV stations a lot, but was there anybody else that was covering radio news in Charleston to the extent that WTMA was?
Not to that extent. There was a WPAL, I believe it was, which was a black station, and they were pretty good. They were pretty active. The radio stations that were affiliated with TV stations were active. But usually just the TV people would take care of it. But I really think that WTMA pretty much dominated the news. There were no news and talk stations in those days, at least not in Charleston. So there was not a whole lot of competition. We didn't listen to other stations' news or watch TV news. We'd take a look at the newspaper in the morning, but I know a lot of stations will just sort of copy what other stations are doing, and we didn't do that. Tried to be original and unique.
It's 48 degrees, our low for tonight in the low 30s. This is Steve Bell, WTMA News on Tuesday, November 25th, 1975.
Coming up next on the History of TMA, we'll spend some time with the news director from our last days as a music formatted station.
The History of TMA.
This hour, we've been hearing from some of the voices who gathered, edited, wrote, and delivered the news on WTMA during our music radio days.
From Communications Exchange, WTMA.
Where the facts come first and best at half past.
COMEX News!
Next up, Warren Ashmore, who had the distinction of being the final full-time news director from that era.
Thank you, Stephen. Good afternoon. Retiring budget official Woody Brooks could be held responsible for damages to a state car in that Williamsburg County wreck if he wasn't on state business. But his secretary said today he was working on a water and sewer problem that day. She said Brooks, head of the local government division of the State Budget and Control Board, had been visiting with the mayor in his hometown of Andrews discussing a water and sewer problem prior to the wreck that injured seven people.
Let's see. We were there in 85 and 86, left just before January of 87.
When the station changed to a country format and let everybody go.
Absolutely. That was kind of the beginning of the next phase of my life. It kind of prompted some decisions, but had two good years there. And, you know, it's strange how things come back to you. I was listening to the interview you did recently with Jay Donovan, and he's talking about the two transmitters that were in the back of the building. Of course, being there in Charleston, there were always hurricanes floating up the coast, and we never quite knew where they were going to be. And I remember one night there was one that was just off the coast, and we couldn't decide where it was going to land. And we told the management we would stay on the air until the water got into the transmitting tower, and then we were out of there regardless of what was going on with all of that power. And then one afternoon, I was there late in the afternoon working, and we smelled something very strong, and it turned out that one of the stages of the FM transmitter had caught fire, and that was right behind the AM studio. And there was some concern of I forgot who was on the air at the moment, but as the fireman came running down the hall to try to figure out how to put out an electrical fire, it was some interesting days there on the bay, if you will.
All that electricity surrounded by all that water.
Oh, yes. You know, and that was always the challenge, that if that water in the bay got too high and got into those buildings, of course, we were going to be wading around in highly charged water, and that was not something we wanted to do.
Now, where were you before you came to WTMA? What was your broadcast background?
I had moved to Charleston in mid-'81 with WCSC as their news director and stayed there, I guess, about a year. and then went through a period of doing nothing for about 8 months, better known as unemployment, and then hooked up with WIXR, which had just opened over in Mount Pleasant, was living over there. Worked for them on a part-time basis for a little while, kind of keeping ends together. I had a wife and two young children, and just having moved down from New Bern, North Carolina, they were not willing to move again, and neither was I. Could have probably found a job quicker if we had moved, but really enjoy Charleston. I think from the moment my wife and I got married back in 71, one of our goals was to live in Charleston, and so we were just unwilling to move very quickly. So worked at IXR part-time and then was offered a full-time job over at WGCA as their news director and was working over there when the CJ and Buzz team called me in early 85 and said, would you like to come over here and be news director? And so was over there for the last, 4 to 6 months of the CJ and Buzz morning team, did the morning news with them. And so that was kind of how I got there.
What was it like working with CJ and Buzz? What were they all about from your perspective?
I mean, this was a wild team, and I always did my news, even though we had the dual control boards in the main control room, I did most of my newscast out of the news booth, and I could not see them. And, of course, being somewhat of a comedian myself or liking to cut up, a lot of times in radio, you know, we play off of each other's visual cues, and so it got to be kind of crazy sometimes with the zaniness of those two, but it was really interesting. They were very successful, and they treated me with respect, and although I was very serious about news, I was always willing to cut up with them, and I think that was part of my success with them. I didn't contribute anything to them other than just a foil sometimes, but it was a fun time to be there.
Do you remember who you replaced as a news director?
No, I don't. I guess I was kind of, at that time, rocking in oblivion over at WGCA and really wasn't aware of who was at TMA. I know that TMA was kind of the station next to CSC that everybody wanted to work for, so I was quite pleased when they called and asked me to come over there. And we were talking about morning people, of course. After CJ and Buzz came Jay Donovan, and that was a trip. When Jay came in, I started doing the news across from him. We had our differences in humor, but we got along real well, and I remember one day Jay went down a road that I didn't particularly want to go with a joke, and so I just kind of stood there, and after we got back into the music, I looked at Jay and I said, you know, some of this I'm just not comfortable with, and that's all right. I don't have any problem with you doing it. So if I'm feeling uncomfortable, I'll back away and lean against the window, and that'll be your cue. You're on your own. But Jay was fun to work with. Real nice guy. I enjoyed all of the people I worked with there. Steve King was the program director, and he came in after CJ and Buzz left. Most of my dealings were with Jay in the morning and Steve, of course, being program director. And then, of course, Bill Poston was the newsman who was on staff when I was there. Bill was kind of a holdover. He was there before I came, and very frankly, at times, I wondered why they didn't offer him the news director slot and bring in somebody under him. Because Bill was a very competent newsman, very intense at times, but could be a lot of fun. We always talk about certain things in our lives. Where were you when certain things happened? And I remember I had just finished my noonday shift and turned it over to Bill and had walked out to the front lobby to kind of shoot the breeze with the receptionist and a couple other people on lunch breaks. Suddenly the receptionist picked up the phone and she said, Bill wants you back in the newsroom. And it was about 10 after 12. He said, CNN has just broadcast the pictures of the Challenger exploding. And of course that ended up being several days of work, you know, pulling together side stories and everything. I think that's kind of the one major thing that happened while I was there was the Challenger exploding. And I remember calling my wife, who was working for an architectural firm downtown in Charleston, and calling several other friends because the shuttle program had become kind of lax at that point in that the networks didn't broadcast every time they took one off. And CNN was the only network covering it. And Bill was just watching it to see what was going on nationally and saw it live.
So it was a two-person news staff, you and Bill?
Yeah. And, of course, I got to the station around 3 o'clock in the morning and went on the air at 6 and worked till noon. We did news on the half hour, every half hour from 6 until 10, and then at that point we shifted to on the top of the hour until 3 in the afternoon. And then from 3 to 6 in drive time, we did news every half hour. And, you know, the challenges of being a two-person news department is you run yourself ragged. We did a lot of stuff by phone. A lot of the officials in town were very generous to make room for us to do phone interviews on things that were coming up or things that had happened. But it was not unusual for Bill to come in early or me to stay late to cover news conferences that had been called that we knew we had to be there for, and then participated in getting things written up and prepared. Of course, we were part of Mutual News at that point. We carried Larry King live overnight, and they carried Mutual News on the hour after 6 o'clock. I still have somewhere in my tapes several news feeds that I did to Mutual News one evening when a hurricane was along the coast and turned in at Buford rather than coming on up the coast. And I remember what sparked it. I was listening to like the 10 o'clock news, and I had already seen on the wire and had already heard from a couple other sources that the hurricane had turned in just below Buford and was doing minor damage. And Mutual came on the air and said the hurricane is still lingering off the coast. So I called Mutual and told them who I was and where I was and said, you know, we have reports the hurricane is now ashore and everything. So they had me do something I had never done before, and probably the only time I've ever been on network news. They had me ad-lib two or three reports or just kind of descriptions of what was going on for the next 2 or 3 hours. I led Mutual News, if you will, with stories of what the hurricane was doing and everything. Life was never dull down there with the hurricanes and just the normal stuff of being in radio at that point.
What about the end of WTMA as a viable, live, fully staffed music format? What was that like? Did you know about it? Was there any writing on the wall, so to speak, or did it come as a total shock?
It caught me by surprise. It's interesting that the newsman was one of the last ones to know, but we weren't in a lot of contact with the front office management. When you come in at 3 and leave at noon, by the time the management is ready to talk to you or you could sit down with them, you've already left for the day because you've already put in 8 hours. But I remember that Steve King, bless his heart, called me at home on a Wednesday night, and he said he had just talked with Bob Winters, who at that time was the general manager, and that the corporation had made the decision that as of January 1 of 87, they were going to automate the AM station, and that all of the staff was going to be let go at least by January 1st. And he said, I have it on good authority that you're going to be called in tomorrow morning and have to make a decision. And he said, I didn't want you to be caught by surprise, but he said, please, you have to be very careful because I'll lose my job if they find out I warned you. So I got called in and was told that indeed we were going to automate and that one of us in the news department could work 2 more weeks and then would be terminated and the other person could stay for 6 weeks. And having had time to think about it and talk about it with my wife the night before, and I had already decided that I was going to fire myself and leave Bill Poston. Part of this came because I was at that time working on the weekend pastoring a small church out on John's Island, St. John's United Methodist. That was a source of some income. I certainly wasn't going to be able to live off of that, but my wife had a good job, and we were looking at that point at going to seminary sometime in the next year and a half or 2 years, and so we just kind of looked at it that this was something that we could deal with. So I honored Steve's request. I asked Bob if I could have an hour to think about it, which I really didn't need. I'd already made my decision. I went back in the news department, sat by myself, did another newscast, walked back to the front and said, I'm fired, which kind of caught him by surprise. But my whole reasoning was that Gail and myself, she had a good job and I knew that we could survive until things straightened out. Bill was married to a young lady who was studying medicine at MUSC, and he was the sole support at that time. So I just made the decision that he needed more time to find a job because he was the sole support. So I fired myself, walked back down the hallway, said to Bill, you have 6 weeks to find a job, explain what was going on. Went in and did my noon newscast, said goodbye, and was gone from WTMA just that quick.
Looking back at your time at WTMA and the times that you lived in Charleston, what do you think WTMA meant to you as your broadcast career progressed, and what do you think the WTMA meant to Charleston and the Lowcountry over the years?
For the Lowcountry, I think TMA was one of those traditional stations that had been around quite a while. It had a good reputation. Coming in as news director, for me, it meant that I needed to put my best foot forward. Here was a station that was respected, was as an AM station struggling against the building dominance of FM, but just insisted that it was going to survive, that it was going to be there to provide news and information as well as entertainment. And I think that it was living up to the reason it came into being, and that was to be kind of an entertainment and information source for the Lowcountry. And for me, it was really a joy to work for that kind of company that knew it mattered and wanted to make a difference in the market. And I know it was probably a hard decision for the management to do what it did of taking it to an automated format, but at least it survived. And I think that that's the important part, that the owners understood that this was a station that needed to be on the air and needed to be there. And that was what I lived with each day, that we wanted to be sure that if we reported something, it was right. If we reported something, that we were as quick to get there and to have it right as possible. And in the programming side, as far as the music and the DJs on the air, there was that sense that we're doing something that matters to this community, and we need to put our best foot forward.
This is John Quincy, and I hope you've enjoyed this hour of the history of TMA. I'd like to invite you to check out the website I've put together dedicated to WTMA's history. The address is WTMAmemories.com. There are lots of rare WTMA recordings you can stream or download, along with pictures of past personnel and promotions. That's WTMAmemories.com. I'd be honored if you make it one of your favorites, as well as keep 1250 WTMA as one of your radio favorites. After all, we are the Charleston radio station that's made history, as well as report it, since 1939. 1250 WTMA.